Sea Realm Vault Podcast, episode number 397. Sunday, April 18th, 2021.
The light of consciousness shines on everyone, but not everyone gains access to the vault.
Hello and happy Saturday. You know why it's a super happy Saturday for me? It's not tax day. I thought it was, and I didn't think that I was going to get done. So I sent the request for automatic extension form to a friend and asked her to print it for me. And when I got over there, she said, you know, it's not tax day, right? You've got until May 17th. And I've been all over the IRS website and I've seen the 17 repeatedly. I certainly knew that the 17th was tax day. But the M-A-Y that came before it, just noise, didn't mean anything to me. Anyway, that's good news. So, I have not yet gotten my COVID shot. I have an appointment for the 19th to get my first of two, most likely. And I haven't decided whether I'm going to keep that appointment. I'm not doing a bunch of research, really. I'm just going to, well, I don't know what I'm going to do, and I'm not even going to tell you what strategy that I'm going to employ, because I don't even know. I mean, I could say something right now. I could make up some pretty story about heuristics and epistemology and you know, fancy words, but I don't know. What I am going to do is read some of the very, I think, genuine, heartfelt, intelligent, and entertaining messages that I have received from you good people on this topic. What to believe? What to believe? What's going on? Who to trust? What to do? All right. So I'm just going to go. I don't even have the emails picked out yet. I'm just going to go to my Gmail inbox, and I'm going to search for any email that includes the word mask. And there's a bunch of them. They're not all from, you know, Sea Realm listeners. We're going to start off with Ben. This is not Ben a Rubber, a frequent contributor to the live chat when I was doing a lot of live streams on YouTube, which I'm not anymore. One, I'm just out of the habit, and two, YouTube is super hyper-censorious right now, and better just to lie low, let the existing strike on my channel drop off, and then, you know, go back with a bit of leeway. Because, you know, you can easily get two strikes in 2 days and they come like 3-4 days later and you don't know that you've gotten them and you're just continuing on your merry way, just, you know, saying whatever comes into your head, not understanding that the algorithm is there making the little hash mark on your, you know, on your form. And then they tell you a little bit later, oh, yeah, you've been running your mouth and we don't like what you're saying. So your channel and the hundreds of videos that you've uploaded to it in the past, shit canned, memory hold, done, bye-bye. So, I'm not in a good place, psychologically, with YouTube right now. But, Ben writes, and this is, he just hit reply to a conversation, an email thread that started back in October of 2019. And on April 9th of this year, Ben just hit reply to that. I do that all the time. You know, a two-year-old email conversation, I'll just reply rather than start a new thread. Hi again. We're in pretty vastly different situations again. I just listened to your most recent podcast about the efficacy of masks and their other effects. I guess I just wanted to communicate my experiences, more of the last 12 months than masks, specifically. I'm in a pretty privileged position down here in the South Island of New Zealand, isolated from the rest of the world pretty securely. This all might come across as a brag. That's not my intention. I just want to let you know how things are here, and for me. Maybe you'll at least find another experience interesting. We had a short and sudden lockdown. At the time, a lot of the world thought was over the top, but maybe not. We were told at the time by the officials that there was no need to wear masks unless you had symptoms, but to act in public as if you have COVID. My personal experience of lockdown was, again, pretty privileged. We live on an acre with fruit trees and a veg garden. I have two kids, aged at the time 7 and 8. Lockdown happened right at the beginning of autumn, when the weather is mostly settled here. I work in construction. The country was told you have 3 days to get your shit in order and go home. What this meant was closing down building sites and telling clients, sorry, all those schedules we discussed are completely out the window. I'm going home. We'll start back up when we can. That was both stressful but also a kind of relief. The government had put immediately in place a relief package that nearly everyone was eligible for. The form online was hilarious. It was like 3 questions. Name, tax number, bank account, and do you forecast a drop in earnings of more than 30% in the next 2 months? Like 4 days later, the money was in our accounts. About 7,500 New Zealand dollars per person. This obviously meant a pretty well-adhered-to lockdown. Only supermarkets and their supply chains, hospitals, and doctors were open. Seriously, nothing else. Every day, the Prime Minister would front to media to give an update with the Health Minister and various experts. All questions were answered, and if something was unknown because one particular expert wasn't there, then it would be found out and they would probably be on the podium the next day. It was a masterclass in communication. Then, what we saw was what we were told we would see if we all just did the thing together. Case numbers dropped, restrictions were lifted. We had a great time. I was hopeful that some more meaningful change would be affected by this in a more environmentally conscious direction. But, like I said, I work in construction, so it would be hypocritical of me to argue for degrowth, for example. At the moment here in New Zealand, construction is booming like I've never seen before. Hot tubs are basically sold out nationwide, and we have the country back to ourselves. The roads are quieter with no tourists. However, if you worked in tourism, it's a different story. Mass layoffs and struggling businesses. We are opening up a travel bubble with Australia soon, and they're all trying to staff up. The problem is the pay is shit, so no one wants to work there. A lot of their staff were people on working holiday visas. They are not here anymore. Whereas over in my business, I've just given a couple of people pay raises. Going to be interesting. I've rambled long enough. Time to get up and make coffee. One more thing. I'm watching the SpaceX Starship development as well, and I'm glad you seem to share the same enthusiasm for it. Fucking nuts, right? Later, KMO. Ben. So, yeah. New Zealand definitely does things differently than the United States, and in this instance, certainly more effectively. On the SpaceX front, I mean, yeah. I know there's some listeners who are not enthusiastic about space exploration, and certainly not enthusiastic about anything that involves Elon Musk in any way. But there it is. Space. The final frontier. Not. You know, I was like 1 year old, I think, when the first human set foot on the moon, and I was definitely still in my single digits the last time that happened. And I was pretty excited about the space shuttle, you know, in the early 80s. And I was pretty broken up about it with the Challenger and Columbia disasters. But, you know, even at the time, I was aware of people saying, look, the space shuttle just goes up to low Earth orbit. We just went to the moon. What are we doing messing around in low Earth orbit? I mean, yeah, you got to get up there to put satellites up in the sky. But other than that, what were we doing for frickin' decades? What were we doing? Because, you know, the Soviet Union collapsed 30 years ago, and it seems like all of our efforts in space were just stunts trying to demonstrate that we were better than the Soviet Union. And I've noticed that since the Soviet Union fell, you know, the U.S. and the First World generally doesn't have anything to prove in terms of how well the people live. There is no competition, really. But anyway, that's not all to do with masks and COVID, so let's look for another message here. Okay, so what I'm looking at here is the Patreon entry. I just posted a link to the most recent free Sea Realm podcast. That was Sea Realm podcast episode number 569, Anecdotes, Trump Data. Right. There I was talking with Dr. Stephen Vinoy, who is an experimental psychologist. That's not that he's experimenting on people, but he's familiar. He's well-versed in experimental methods. And he's also a practicing, I don't know if he's a psychologist or a psychiatrist. The difference being a psychiatrist is an MD who is licensed to prescribe drugs. But anyway, I, you know, related to him, the multiple experiences I've had here in Bellows Falls, where I'm outdoors, it's a windy day, and I'm about to pass an older woman on the sidewalk. She's wearing a mask, I'm not, and they ostentatiously stop, turn 90 degrees, step out into traffic, and glare at me as I walk past them. And I described this behavior in terms of the neurological rewards that they were getting for it. And Dr. Vinoy, he expressed surprise that I would describe, you know, the situation in those terms, but he didn't disagree or offer any correction or alternative view. So, back to Patreon. Kay writes, I guess my question is, why do you think you won't be hassled just because you get the vaccine? Will you be reassuring the people who step aside from you on the street when you are not wearing a mask that you had the vaccine? I suppose that if we have to carry vaccine passports, you will be able to flash it at those who question you're not wearing a mask. In fact, I thought we ought to come up with some kind of cool-looking talisman that we that we are proof against COVID and claim it as a religious practice. What do you think? So I responded to this in writing. I wrote, I don't care about the old lady hippies and their scowls of disapproval. I'm concerned about the methods that the government and big tech companies will employ to marginalize and punish the people who don't get the vaccine. What methods will they try? Myriad. Most will prove ineffectual, but some will really sting, and those are the ones they'll double down on. Is it cowardly to surrender before I've even seen the weapons they plan to employ? Maybe. But by the time you feel the sting of the lash, it's too late to avoid it. And Kay responded, my apologies. You have more reason than most to be concerned about the sting of the lash. Hope you get to travel soon. And Ben, who is Ben a Rubber, also commented, I'm lucky here in Auburn, New York. I've never experienced the mask shaming like you talk about in Vermont. We have more than a handful of Trump flags still up around the city. It's just not a deep blue place like Vermont, I guess. Well, no place is a deep blue place like Vermont. Vermont is a very, very special place for the Blue Tribe. Continuing, Ben a Rubber writes, we don't have a mask mandate for being outside. The parent talking about seeing kids struggle to really play when they're trying to social distance with masks on sounds shitty. The Wegmans grocery store actually has a policy of leaving customers who choose not to wear a mask alone. At first, I was upset by them doing that, while smaller businesses were getting fined for their customers not wearing masks, but now I'm appreciative. I still wear my mask inside buildings or in closed areas. And then he links to auburnpub.com/news/local/Wegmans fined. Yeah, so it's an article about that. And there, I guess this is a quote from the article. Quote, what it appears some would have us do is confront and physically try to force the person to leave the store. And that is a line Wegmans has decided it can't cross. Close quote. John C. writes, the synopsis of this episode made me smile. I interpreted it as oppositionally defiant KMO gives the finger to YouTube for banning him for disseminating unspecified COVID misinformation by doing all the misinformations. Of course, you handled the topics a lot more thoughtfully than that, as usual. My position on masks was established early on in the pandemic when Fauci and company said that we should not wear them in a transparent attempt to prevent a shortage that would endanger healthcare workers. That told me that masks definitely work and we should all be wearing them all the time. I'm a tad oppositionally defiant myself. The anti-mask movement seems irrational to me. Virtue-signaling red tribers willing to spread disease and death to own the libs is the position I understand the most, I suppose because I'm the flip side of that coin. I'm sure my judgment is influenced by the fact that I have several comorbidities, as do many of my family members, and also by the fact that I'm an essential worker. I'm more likely to have a bad time if I get it, and I'm also more likely to get it and spread it to others. So unlike Liam, I'm not that concerned if masks aren't as effective as some of their proponents say they are. I'm more concerned about whether they are effective at all. And I believe there is more than sufficient evidence that they are. My kids are the ones you'll see riding bikes with masks on. Sure, the risk that they'll catch the virus while biking around the neighborhood is very small, but it's also not zero. Yeah, I'd say it's as close to zero as to be effectively zero, but anyway. If wearing a mask adds a little more protection, why not wear one? Well, I'll just stop, and this is me, you know, responding to the question, why not wear one? Because there are downstream psychological effects of people, one, not being able to show their face, and two, being publicly shamed for showing their faces in public. That's bad. It's just bad. And if the benefit is minuscule to non-existent, then it's bad for no good reason. It's not a trade-off, it's just a harm. John continues, I mean, they're also wearing helmets, and that's arguably doing less to protect them than the masks. No, head injury is a real thing. When your head hits the pavement, you can injure your brain. Your brain basically has the consistency of oatmeal. It doesn't have much internal structure that is, you know, really resilient. That's why you have a skull. Helmets are a good thing, although the kids that I've seen riding bikes around here wearing masks were not wearing helmets. John continues, also, since they live with me, they are more likely to catch COVID and spread it. So their mask is also to protect the community. Yeah, but when they're out on their bikes riding down the street at high speed, they're not with you. They're at no risk of catching COVID from you at that time. And yet, you know, the damage, the psychological, social damage of, you know, being shamed for showing your face in public, that persists. Anyway, John writes, also, since they live with me, they are more likely to catch COVID and spread it. So their mask is also to protect the community. There's literally no downside to wearing a mask that I'm aware of, and a significant upside. Yeah, I think it's the exact opposite. But anyway, John writes, the anecdote I will be taking away from the pandemic is March 2020 through March 2021 is the first year of my life that I didn't even have a slight cold. I would suggest intermittent fasting. When I was on an intermittent fasting regimen for years on end, I never got any sort of infectious disease like that. But John continues writing, I'm also enthusiastically pro-vaccine. This is in no small part because the mRNA vaccines are cool as hell. Well, I will agree, they are cool as hell. Continuing, creating a vaccine by reverse engineering the virus DNA is the cyberpunk future that I signed up for. But mostly I've been isolating from my extended family in order to protect them, and I miss them terribly. Once we're all vaccinated, I figure we'll have a few months where we can embrace and share a meal in the same room. Then in late August / early September, SARS-CoV-2B.1.351, aka the South African variant of concern, will tear through the reopened public schools filled with unvaccinated children and force us to lock down again, at least until the boosters become available around January. Okay, I don't know if you're joking there, but from my perspective, as ineffectual as it has been to prevent the spread of COVID, the lockdown measures and all the other measures taken, you know, particularly the legislative remedies, have been such a boon to the billionaire class that obviously they're going to do it again. You know, if it worked so well in transferring wealth to the top, they're going to do it again. So yes, there absolutely will be regular virus scares from now on. John concludes, finally, in defense of scowling old hippie ladies, not all of them are getting a buzz off of righteous indignation, and sanctimony. In fact, I suspect very few are. They're just afraid, as we all are. Okay, I'll pause there and say, one, I don't think you live in Vermont. So I know the Vermont hippies better than you know the Vermont hippies. I know the righteous buzz that they're all stoked on. And two, yeah, they probably are afraid, but from my perspective, allowing yourself to remain in a perpetual state of fear based on abstractions is a sin. Fear and anger both disrupt, you know, the ability for critical thinking, but fear is much worse. And to allow oneself to feel a continuous state of fear when there are steps that you can take, there are measures that you can take to change that sensation in yourself, to quell it, to stop it, to at least dampen it down. If you don't take advantage of those, but you know how to do it and you don't, that's just, you know, that's like putting lead in the water supply. Fear makes people stupid. Now, I remember back around 9/11, it was mostly the Red Tribe that was propagating fear. You know, we were supposed to be afraid of the terrorists. Afraid, afraid, afraid. Now it's the Blue Tribe that's stoking fear. And I don't care who does it. It's reprehensible. It's reprehensible to try to engender fear in others, and it's reprehensible to allow it to continue in yourself when you realize that you're living in a perpetual state of fear. John continues, the masked frowning at the maskless are coming from the same place as the vaccine-hesitant person afraid of being Big Pharma's guinea pig that wrote to you. We're all trying to come to terms with the fact that whether we live or die and the circumstances thereof are largely dictated by powers and events that are out of our control. And we resent the fuck out of it. Well, yeah, you and I are in total agreement on that. Given this, I just try to meet people where they are, with compassion and tons of slack. We're all doing our best. We're not all doing our best. But anyway, we're all doing our best. Will I still walk on the shoulder to distance myself from a maskless person on the sidewalk? Yes. But I will also almost always tip my hat or wave, or in some way acknowledge our shared humanity. The few times I don't are because I'm engrossed in a really good podcast. Well, speaking as somebody who walks down the street and crosses the street all the time while wearing not only headphones, but noise-canceling headphones. Now, I don't have the noise-canceling function on when I'm walking around out, you know, around cars. But, yeah. As somebody who does that all the time, let me just encourage you, keep that neck limber, swivel it a lot, and look around quite a bit. Could save your life. But thank you for that message, John. Obviously, we were in fairly significant disagreement there, but we're definitely in agreement on acknowledging the humanity of the people who disagree with us. This is a regular talking point of mine, but you know, one of the sins that Twitter and Facebook and the rest encourage us to participate in is to treat the people who express opinions that we disagree with as nothing more than the embodiment of a heinous opinion. We don't treat them as humans, we treat them as symbols, whereas if we were dealing with them in real life, we would understand that they are complex entities responding to a complex world with partial information and, you know, shaky folk wisdom as a guide. Okay, and Parker wrote on the topic of masks. This is way back from April 2nd, and the whole email isn't about masks. But in his final paragraph, Parker writes, I will admit, I was very slightly annoyed when I saw your title last week that was about ending the mask mandate. But then I thought, this is just the kind of provocative title that draws people in. And it's not like you are doing an in-store public freakout being led out by security. This is my association of people against masks. You are asking the question and having a good conversation about it. You and your guests were appealing to science. It was not like you doing anti-vaxxer or flat earth propaganda. Well, thank you, Parker, for that very faint praise. Now, let me just reiterate here that I've been kicked off of YouTube supposedly for disseminating medical misinformation. But when you get kicked off of YouTube, they don't tell you what it was that you said that they found offensive. They just pronounce you guilty of the crime and they present no evidence. Your only recourse is to appeal. And the appeal, in my experience, is just automatically denied. And again, with no elaboration as to what it was you said. And in the case of the live stream, you know, unless you are saving your live streams to your local hard drive, they delete it. So you can't even go back and re-listen to what it was that got you banned and try to figure out what the offensive part was. And I wrote to Parker. He suggested that I stream on Twitch, but I've been streaming on Twitch. I use Restream to stream simultaneously to YouTube, Twitch, and Picarto. And I never have anybody watching on Twitch or Picarto. It's all YouTube. And I close with, right now, I don't even know if I'm going to continue streaming on YouTube at all. I might go back to uploads only. And that's not entirely true. I do one live stream a week from the TV station, and I'm going to continue to do that until I get kicked off. I won't get kicked off the TV station. I'll get kicked off of YouTube, most likely. And the conversation with Parker continues from there, but it's all about, you know, streaming and social media and big tech basically owning the new public square and censoring people with impunity, which is, you know, definitely a relevant topic. But it's not what I'm talking about right now. Concerning my last conversation with Jim, your ad attacker, Jim, well, let me just read a message from Jeff here. This is Jeff with a G. Jeff writes, Hi, KMO. Definitely enjoyed your show with Jim. You both are naturals, though I know it took many years of work and practice to become naturals. And it's always a pleasure to hear you both speak. And then I don't know what this acronym is. He says, capital C, capital A, lowercase s. CA is for the correction. It sounded as if Jim was under the impression that Andrew Jackson was on Mount Rushmore. If I heard incorrectly, my apologies, but the four presidents there are Washington, Jefferson, Teddy Roosevelt, and Lincoln. And, you know, I remember scratching my head as well when Jim said, you know, figuratively scratching my head when Jim said that Andrew Jackson was on Mount Rushmore. I didn't immediately look it up, but I was trying to picture Mount Rushmore in my head. I went there as a kid, and I remember that I only recognized three of the four presidents up there. I guess we just don't have, you know, as a culture, we don't have that many popular sort of iconic images of Thomas Jefferson. The only one I can think of is the Jefferson Monument, you know, at the Tidal Pool in D.C. And the face, you know, his portrait on Mount Rushmore, and Jeff included an image of Mount Rushmore, his face looks very feminine on Mount Rushmore, to the point where I think a lot of people assume that, or have even said, you know, that it's a portrait of Martha Washington. Jeff continues, also, in the bring that dead horse over here so I can reach him easier department, I have to once more question the efficacy of hydrochloroquine. Jim quoted a doctor, in scare quotes, practitioner, question mark, in parentheses, who was disciplined and finally fired for dosing her patients with hydroxychloroquine and vitamins and having great success with them, being conveniently and impossible to document, that the hospital administrators told her to stop because there was, quote, no money in it for the hospital, close quote. Further, Jim said she was next seen in the rotunda of the Capitol on January 6th. Along those lines, in Brazil, Bolsonaro stockpiled and was gifted from the U.S. in May 2020 so much hydrochloroquine that there would have been plenty to treat a sizable portion of the population of Brazil. And yet, to date, this so-called miracle drug has not been used. Right now, USA is number one in COVID deaths worldwide, and Brazil is number two and closing. Bolsonaro, like Trump, touted its effectiveness, and it defies logic that if it actually worked, either of them, or both, would have not gone all out to distribute and take all the credit for saving the country. I'll admit that I don't like either of them, but I'm willing to give even my adversaries a win, and if this truly was effective, would have been a huge win, in fact, a win-win for all of us. So by Occam's razor, I'm afraid I have to call bullshit once again on hydroxychloroquine. So I'm going to pause here, cut in, and say I don't have an opinion on hydroxychloroquine. I did have Robert Brown on the podcast talking about the effectiveness of ivermectin as an early treatment for COVID-19, you know, for mildly symptomatic cases that don't require hospitalization. And, you know, he also sang the praises of vitamin D. But again, that's ivermectin, not hydroxychloroquine. Jeff continues, I'm of the extraordinary claims need extraordinary proof school of logic, and so far hydroxy doesn't clear that bar. Ivermectin, on the other hand, which I described my position on to a true believer friend as skeptical but not dismissive, seems to possibly be progressing towards that extraordinary proof. I like rigorous random-controlled double-blind trials with results openly published and reviewed by statistical analysts who actually get paid to do this type of work. Tends to be a proxy for them having skin in the game. And this looks like ivermectin may be headed in that direction. And then he posts a link. This is pubmed.ncbi.nlm.nih.gov/ and then a long number. And Jeff concludes, I don't hold my particular prejudices about scientific studies as transcendentally able to deliver truth, but they work for me. It's just how I roll. All the best, Jeff. So I will just pause and say, I saw Carl Sagan's Cosmos series when I was a kid in the 80s. Loved it. It was life-changing. I mean, I absolutely loved it. And I think as a promoter of the scientific worldview, you know, scientists, I'm certainly not the first to say this, they are notoriously bad communicators, particularly when it comes to speaking to the public and non-scientists. And to have somebody like Carl Sagan, who was, you know, one, a competent scientist and, you know, mostly astronomer and astrophysicist, and two, really well able to communicate complex scientific ideas to a non-specialist public, he was such a gift. I just love Carl Sagan. I'm so happy that he is a part of, you know, my childhood and also a part of the intellectual history of the country in which I live. That said, the notion that extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence is very, very dangerous stuff. Definitely, I highly advise anybody who ever says that or who hears it and thinks that it sounds smart, banish that from your thinking. That is dangerous bullshit. The same standards of evidence need to be applied to all claims. If you say that claims which are extraordinary require extra scrutiny and have to, you know, present even greater evidence, even, you know, greater argument, greater argumentation, more evidence. If they have to prove themselves to a higher standard than other claims, well, then who gets to decide what an extraordinary claim is? Extraordinary according to what? Common sense? Extraordinary according to other claims which have been accepted as part of your cultural narrative? Why do things which don't seem extraordinary because they are familiar to you get to skate by with a lower standard of evidence? That is just formalizing and providing a privileged position to, you know, to normalcy bias. Basically just, you know, just codifying the natural psychological tendency to give a pass to ideas which seem, you know, familiar and uncontroversial to us. Dangerous, dangerous stuff. Don't do that. That's the dumbest thing Carl Sagan ever said in public. You know, he was a human being. He surely got mad at people for bad reasons and, you know, said dumb stuff in private. But in terms of what he said in public, that's the dumbest thing he ever said, you know, in a career of saying very smart things to the public. You know, when I was in community college in the late 80s in Kansas City, Missouri, I was a protege of a guy named Verl Muir. He was a philosophy teacher there, but, you know, he was pretty half-assed in his teaching of philosophy. His real passion was for criticizing religions and religious people and for debunking psychics and other flim-flam men. He was a member of the CSICOP, Committee for the Scientific Investigation for Claims of the Paranormal. And Verl Muir used to put on a magic act where he claimed to be psychic and he would convince a whole room full of people that he had psychic powers. And then he would say, no, I'm using the same sleight of hand and same psychological tricks that all psychics use to fool people and bilk them out of their money. I imagine he's dead now, but he was a not particularly attractive human being. And he once went to a faith healing rally in drag and supposedly got cured of ovarian cancer on stage there, you know, by the faith healer. So, you know, I have very personal firsthand experience with this crowd of people, the people who are really, you know, who consider themselves to have a scientifically grounded worldview and who are very, you know, hyper skeptical about people who claim experiences, you know, who claim encounters with aliens or who claim, you know, to have experienced astral projection or contact with dead loved ones or, you know, paranormal stuff. And I remember, you know, Verl used to have various people that he knows come and present to his students. And James Randi came. You know, I had got to have lunch with James Randi one day because of my association with this philosophy teacher at a community college in Kansas City, Missouri, but also Paul Kurtz. So if you have any knowledge whatsoever of the, you know, the skeptic community, you certainly know who Paul Kurtz is. And he came and he gave a talk in front of a pretty big audience, not just of, you know, philosophy students, but a lot of people came to this. And I remember one person in the Q&A asked about, you know, what Paul Kurtz thought about Whitley Strieber's narrative about being abducted by aliens. And I didn't know much about Whitley Strieber at the time. I hadn't read Communion. The movie hadn't come out yet. So I wasn't really sure who Whitley Strieber was. But the first and only thing that Paul Kurtz said on the topic was, you know, Whitley Strieber claims to have been anally raped by the aliens. I was still a community college student. You know, most of my philosophy education was ahead of me at that point. But I could tell that's just poisoning the well. I mean, I maybe didn't have the vocabulary to say that, but, you know, just taking out of context the most shocking or, you know, dissonant thing that is contained in a person's testimony and just presenting that on its own, you know, point blank up front just for the shock value in order to get you to assume that, you know, the rest of the narrative is equally, you know, equally loony and the person promoting it is equally loony. That's not good rational hygiene. And I don't remember who said this, and I'm not going to look up the quote exactly, but there's a really good quote that I read about this years ago. Isn't it interesting how the people who describe themselves as skeptics are not particularly skeptical about, say, the Federal Reserve? You know, they're not skeptical about the actions of government. They're not skeptical about the claims of big corporations. They are just hyper-focused on a very narrow set of claims that they think need to be, you know, debunked or examined or held to a higher standard of evidence than other types of claims. And I think that's just wrong. I think we should be as skeptical of the pronouncements of public figures, you know, about what they did, when they did it, who they did it for, who gave them money and who didn't and when, as we should be of people who are claiming to have been abducted by aliens and anally probed. You know, the whole aliens anally probing people is such a familiar meme right now, and has been for a long time. In the 80s, that wasn't the case. In the 80s, that particular detail of the, you know, the gray alien abduction experience hadn't really made the rounds culturally. This is pre-internet. Okay, now, if you sent me something about masks and I haven't read it yet, well, then you didn't send it via email, because I was just searching my inbox for everything in recent memory, you know, in recent weeks, that includes the word masks. Now I'm popping over to YouTube, and I'm in, you know, the back end here, the part that only I see. And I'm looking at comments from people on videos that I've done recently. And I've only done a couple, three maybe, since I've been able to post to YouTube again. I've shot quite a few of them, and what tends to happen is I'll get in front of the camera, and I'll start talking, and I'll go blah, 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 blah for 20, 25, 30 minutes. And at some point, the camera, either I run out of memory or the battery dies. And so I'll go to watch it later or, you know, edit it later. And I do very minimal editing on my YouTube videos, as you probably know. And it just comes to a, you know, an unceremonious halt. And sometimes I'll post it, and sometimes I'll consider the option of, you know, getting back in front of the camera and trying to finish the thought. But usually I just abandon the whole thing. So in the last few days, and there, here's a video that I posted, well, the comments started coming in 2 days ago, called Acceleration Capitalism and Urbit. Urbit is spelled U-R-B-I-T. And Urbit is a project that Mencius Moldbug, I mean, he used to go by the pen name Mencius Moldbug, but a guy named Curtis Yarvin is involved with. And if you interview him, you either get to talk to him about his cultural views or Urbit, but he doesn't like to cross the streams, or cross the beams, as he says it. You know, it's a Ghostbusters reference. And I tried watching a presentation that he gave about Urbit to technically minded people, and I simply couldn't follow it. But I can follow his cultural stuff. Curtis Yarvin, a.k.a. Mencius Moldbug, is notorious. He is, you know, one of the founding figures of what's called neo-reaction. He also describes himself as a monarchist. He doesn't think that democracy is a good idea. And I guess I've been listening to him recently, and I've listened to his interviews, his recent interviews, and I've listened to enough of them that I've heard, you know, I've heard him start to repeat things, which is my cue to, you know, switch to a different topic, or not a different topic necessarily, but, you know, to stop listening to his stuff for the time being and let him come up with some new talking points before I check out his appearances on the podcast circuit. But his most recent podcast with Thaddeus Russell, and thanks to everybody who's pointed me in the direction of Thaddeus Russell and whose advice I have been ignoring, not necessarily deliberately, but I just never did get around to listening to anything by Thaddeus Russell until just recently, when somebody sent me a link to a conversation that Doug Lane did with him 3 years ago. And that's a very enjoyable conversation. I'm glad I listened to it. So I went to his podcast feed today. His podcast is called Unregistered. And I just noticed that one of the more recent podcasts was a conversation with Curtis Yarvin. So I listened to that today, actually, as I walked to the store. But Curtis Yarvin, not much into democracy. Doesn't really think democracy is a good idea. He would like to see a more corporate form of government. And I know, you know, you hear that, you think, oh my God, that's beyond crazy. That's like just straight up evil, you know, like from Time Bandits, just concentrated evil. Just this little black charcoal, like, you know, dense matter that's slightly glowing and smoking, just concentrated pure evil. And all I can say is, you know, if you listen to one of his interviews, particularly this one with Thaddeus Russell, he's just a really entertaining guy. I mean, he's not a good speaker. A lot of ums, it just, you know, it's like nails on a chalkboard to me to hear that. But man, what an encyclopedic, you know, grasp of history. It's just amazing to listen to, you know, all of the examples that he brings up spontaneously. And, you know, I've talked about things that he repeats in one podcast to another. The historical examples are not something that's on, you know, a short rotation. It's amazing the things that he just you know, just pulls out of his mind. It's like, well, like Terrence McKenna in that way. Terrence McKenna had a prodigious memory, and he could just access it in real time in a way that was, it seemed to border on the supernatural. But, of course, Curtis Yarvin is in opposition to, you know, the crazier elements of the left. I mean, he's not in opposition to the mainstream so much, just, you know, just the more sort of authoritarian elements on the left. And something that, you know, I do this myself. I don't consider myself to be a leftist at all. There might be places where, you know, I would share an opinion with somebody who is a consistent leftist, but I'm not a leftist. But one of the places where I do, you know, I have common opinions and talking points in common with leftists is criticism of capitalism, at least as it's practiced here in the early 21st century in the United States and the countries that are influenced by the United States. What you might say the other, you know, the subjects of the American empire. So this is all a long setup in preparation for reading a short comment from Dan, who writes, "Thanks for the video, KMO. The terms used, capitalism, communism, liberal, conservative, means something that isn't reality. For example, capitalism is an economic and political system in which a country's trade and industry are controlled by private owners for profit rather than by the state, according to Oxford Languages. What occurs in much of the world isn't this, but it gets called capitalism. It's a random collection of phenomena that favor an elite as they clamor to gather more wealth at the expense of everyone else. I won't go through the other terms listed, but I think the discussion of capitalism, for example, like we really have that thing, is non-productive. At least the Dow would not be at 33,000 if we actually had capitalism. The people you talked about who are promoting acceleration because it might bring about an end of capitalism might be right, but we don't have capitalism. And what we have is more likely to morph into some other method of funneling riches to the elite that will still be called capitalism, then cease to exist." And while I still think that, you know, the word capitalism has a meaning and it has real world reference that we can point to, yeah, it definitely is a very slippery concept. And, you know, people do seem to treat it, a lot of people seem to treat it, as if it has a very precise definition, and also as if everything in the world that gets called capitalist or capitalism fits that definition, which it doesn't. So in that same video, I summarized acceleration, or accelerationism, as the idea that, you know, rather than try to carve out a little humanity in the capitalist system, the accelerationists think, well, just let the capitalist system do its thing, go as fast as it wants, you know, pay out all the rope that it wants to use to hang itself with, and eventually it's going to go off the rails. And Synchronium 24 summarized my summarization as, let capitalism do its thing until it breaks, and don't bother with all this leftist pushback. And then he or she goes on to say, I would say that is a fair characterization of leftists that support accelerationism. Nick Land is a supporter of the Dark Enlightenment. I was commenting on a conversation that I heard with Nick Land, who is supposedly, with Mencius Moldbug, or with Curtis Yarvin, one of the two more prominent intellectuals in the neo-reactionary movement. And my criticism was, Land speaks in the same obscure vocabulary with endless references to French intellectuals that, you know, the critical theory people like to talk in. And it's really impenetrable and not very enlightening, you know, to people who are not steeped in that tradition and who haven't read all those books. And, you know, from my perspective, and this is something that I was saying in the video, I'm not convinced that they're saying anything that is worth reading all of those books to, you know, to be able to decipher their tortured prose. I think that, you know, if they were to couch their insights in just vernacular English, that they'd be rather obvious and it would be a very short read. And so there was a very, very long conversation between, I forget the guy's name, some podcaster and Nick Land. And I didn't get through the whole thing. I was interested in the topic, but I just couldn't get through it because it was so many words and so little meaning as far as I could tell. But anyway, Synchronium 24 writes, Nick Land is a supporter of the Dark Enlightenment, which is far right slash reactionary. I think accelerationism would be far more likely to push in the direction of, though not reach, Land's goals than those of leftists. which would be reason enough for me to oppose accelerationism if I didn't already prefer the highly imperfect version of liberalism and capitalism in which I live to what non-accelerationist leftists propose. So Curtis Yarvin is also in this boat. They just don't like equality. They don't think that equality is a fundamental virtue that we should all just support. They think that championing equality leads to bad social outcomes. And, you know, as far as that goes, I don't really have a comment on that. But I do have a comment on Nick Land's version of equality. Nick Land is a transhumanist, and to him, it doesn't matter what happens to the majority of people. If 99.9% of humanity is wiped out, but a tiny elite get to upload into the Matrix or whatever, or, you know, upload into immortal cyborg bodies or android bodies or whatever, and go on to have some glorious high-tech future, well, then that's a win from his perspective. When, you know, for me, I guess it's better than total extinction of our species, but I would much rather see, you know, widespread shared prosperity and a bright future for everybody. And Nick Land just doesn't care about that. That's not a goal of his. It's not a priority of his. He's only interested in the elites. And, you know, to be perfectly honest, I spend a fair amount of my days subjecting the elites to painful and humiliating retribution for having, you know, hoarded the wealth. In my imagination, that is. And Parker writes, the idea that capitalism will break seems similar to the idea of collapse, in that there will almost certainly not be one large inflection point. There are trends, there are individual events. A company or industry may break just as a country or area may collapse, but neither of these things will make for the kind of change that the folks that talk about them are imagining. And I probably don't need to elaborate on that. I'll just say, yep, I agree. Okay. So one last thing before I go, just a new term. I encountered it recently. I posted this on my Patreon page, I think on the 10th of April. Yeah, 10th of April. So really, it's just a link to the Wikipedia entry on Great Compression. The Great Compression refers to, quote, a decade of extraordinary wage compression, close quote, in the United States in the early 1940s. During that time, economic inequality, as shown by wealth distribution and income distribution between the rich and poor, became much smaller than it had been in preceding time periods. So I posted just a link to that Wikipedia entry, and then I wrote the following. I gave it the title, A New Meme to Conjure With. Clearly it isn't new. It's just new to me. I picked it up in the Aki no Kure face-to-face blog that first of Incelmatics alerted me to a week or so ago. I'm thinking of this in terms of the socioeconomic cycles that George Friedman describes in The Storm Before the Calm, America's Discord, The Coming Crisis of the 2020s, and The Triumph Beyond. Jim, your ad attacker, and I talked about the book and its themes in a recent Vault episode. In Friedman's lingo, the Reagan cycle, which ushered in a new era of prosperity by reducing the tax burden on the wealthy, which freed up capital to drive the expansion of the microchip economy, will reach the end of its 50-year run at the end of the 2020s. In the book, Friedman doesn't make any reference to the Great Compression or, as far as I can recall, predict a flattening of the great disparities of accumulated wealth, but he does discuss the dysfunction of higher education and its role as a gatekeeper of opportunity. A return to a widely shared prosperity seems like a prerequisite to the calm that will come with the start of the next socioeconomic cycle. And that post didn't generate a lot of lengthy comments from people. First, Incelmatics shared several links in response, but the Great Compression of the 1940s, it's, you know, it's worth talking about. It's worth having that phrase at the ready and that historical reference, you know, that historical example of a time when, you know, prior to that, you know, in the late 1800s to the turn of the century, that period was known as the Gilded Age. There were various technological advancements which led to large businesses, many of which became monopolies, and enormous fortunes were amassed. That caused enormous disparities of wealth. That was followed by the Great Depression. And I'm certainly no expert on the Great Depression, but I suppose one way you could describe it would be to say that so few people I mean, yes, it started with a stock market crash, but clearly that stock market crash didn't bring down a healthy economy. It was an economy that was way out of whack. Too few people controlled too much of the money, and most people didn't have enough money to cover, you know, just the basics, much less buy necessities and drive a consumer economy, although it wasn't a consumer economy back then the way it is now. And by the end of World War II, lots of workers got shipped overseas to go fight. A lot of them didn't come home. But when they did come home, and the women who had been doing the work, you know, in their absence went back to the home and resumed, not necessarily happily, but resumed their roles as wives and homemakers and mothers, there was not a labor shortage exactly, but there were fewer workers than there had been before. And the workers who came back, you know, many of them were combat veterans. You didn't really want to piss them off. The U.S. had the only intact industrial economy in the world, and the government was afraid of, you know, the workers. And there were a confluence of forces which led to this period of, you know, continued technological advancement, enormous industrial activity driving a consumer economy, and a government that was afraid of the veterans who had just come back from the war and wanted to placate them and keep them from organizing and particularly, you know, keep them from going over to the communist side. There were just lots of reasons for the state and the big corporations to share the wealth, and they did for a long time, basically for most of my father's life. And for most of my life, you know, when I graduated from high school, the Soviet Union was still a thing, but by the time I entered college, like I spent a couple years in community college, by the time I got to a state university, the Soviet Union was gone. And over the next 30 years, the U.S. has just had no reason, you know, or at least no compelling reason, to treat people well and to stop the negative effects of the Reagan cycle. You know, George Friedman talks about these socioeconomic cycles. At their beginning, they solve a systemic problem, and they usher in a new period of prosperity. And with prosperity comes social harmony. But each new paradigm also has, you know, as the Marxists would say, or the leftists would say, its own inherent internal contradictions, in which I would just describe as dysfunctions, which are tolerable for a while, particularly in the early stages while you're enjoying the benefits, but over time become intolerable. And at the end of a cycle, they are utterly intolerable and, you know, people are at each other's throats. They produce great social discord. So we are in the, you know, just swimming in the accumulated toxic backflow from nearly 50 years of the Reagan cycle. Really, we've got another decade to go if we're going to be on George Friedman's timetable, where things just get worse and worse, and the tension gets ratcheted up and up. Although, you know, the election of Biden doesn't really seem to bear that out. Biden seems to have taken a lot of the steam out of the room. You know, people who define themselves by their opposition to Trump for the last 4 years, it's kind of hard to get excited about Biden. Really, in a lot of ways, he's just providing what Donald Trump promised in 2016. He's maintained Trump's hard stance against China. He's still building the wall on the southern border. He's just not the orange man. You know, he can enact the same policies, but just not have the same personality. And without the personality, you know, the people who thought that they were saving the world by watching Rachel Maddow every night, there's just nothing to hold on to. There's nothing to get excited about, but also nothing really to object to. It's just kind of this is something that Curtis Yarvin was talking about a lot in the interview with Thaddeus Russell. So many people got hooked on this fantasy that they were the resistance, you know, during the Trump years. And what do they have now? Climate change? It's just not as exciting. All right. Everything that you've heard up to this point was recorded yesterday, Saturday, April 17th, 2021. There's like another 15 minutes worth of stuff that I recorded yesterday, but at this point, I've just wiped all that. I don't feel like editing it or even listening to it, really. Instead, I've remembered that there's an email from Brent in Kansas, whose place I've stayed at repeatedly over the years. He's a very gracious host, and he's very interested in issues relating to energy and climate change. And let's see, 11 days ago now, Brent sent me an email that reads, "Hey there, KMO. I've been hoping to hear you talk more about Daniel Yergin's new book, The New Map, Energy, Climate, and the Clash of Nations. I remember JHK and others talking dismissively and disparagingly of Jurgen back in the peak of peak oil. I'd be interested to hear you summarize what he's saying now. So I'll read the rest of Brent's email here in a bit. But first, on the Daniel Jurgen front, you know, I will get a copy of the actual printed book from the library if I can, and review it that way rather than listening to the whole audiobook again. I mean, that's one of the drawbacks of audiobooks is they're not easy to review quickly. But one of the things that I really liked about Daniel Jurgen's book, and apparently this is something that a lot of his old fans didn't like, is that it didn't really seem to have any sort of polemic, you know, through line. He wasn't arguing for anything. It's largely a history of the development of the technology that led to the shale revolution, both in oil and natural gas. And it's a long history. So, you know, I was surprised that people were thinking about, you know, getting at these locked up hydrocarbons in shale formations back in the first half of the 20th century. And it took a long time for the technology to come of age and then for the economic conditions to make it economically, you know, feasible to access this stuff for a profit. And, you know, I found the early chapters interesting because it was stuff that I just never heard before. And then the later chapters I found interesting, one, because, you know, he was describing year by year events that were leading to, you know, the full flowering of the shale revolution. And these are the same years in which I was talking to the people who were articulating and propagating the peak oil narrative, you know, in like 2007, 2008, 2009. And then, you know, the narrative comes right up to like yesterday, basically. It's a very new book. And so I was very interested in the, you know, all the political intrigue and the tensions between Ukraine and Russia over natural gas. And also he even covers, you know, Hunter Biden's role serving on the board of, I think it's Gazprom was the name of the company. But again, this book is definitely not a refutation of peak oil. He barely mentions peak oil in the book. It's not arguing in favor of, you know, an abundant energy future or anything like that, as far as I remember. But I would like to review it, you know, not necessarily write a review, but refamiliarize myself with the contents. I've listened to several other books since then, and the details have faded a bit. But again, I think the important thing is it's not a polemic. It's much more a history. But I will go back and particularly look at the final chapters and see if there's any sort of summing up remarks that hint at, you know, maybe even a weak polemic, if not a really emphasized one. And in the podcast that Brent was responding to, I read part of a transcript of a conversation that I think involved Nicole Foss and Dmitry Orlov and definitely Jim Kunstler was in there. And then later in the call, I think they were all in a studio together at a NPR station. And then later Noam Chomsky called in. And Noam Chomsky just in passing, you know, referenced Daniel Jurgen. And Noam Chomsky was saying, you know, peak oil would be good news because that would mean that we don't have, you know, we're not going to suffer the catastrophic effects of climate change. But, you know, if people like Daniel Jurgen are to be believed, that's, you know, peak oil is not going to save us. It's not going to come in time to prevent catastrophic climate change. And just at the mention of the name Daniel Jurgen, you know, Jim just sort of disengaged from the conversation as it had taken place up to that point and just went into attack mode on Jurgen. And that, you know, Chomsky wasn't impressed by that. Chomsky kept trying to bring it back to, yeah, you're missing my point. The point is that if the oil doesn't run out right away, we are going to have to deal with the environmental consequences of burning it, or we're going to have to figure out how to not burn it. And Jim wasn't interested seemingly in engaging that point and really just wanted to discredit and insult Daniel Jurgen. So Brent asks, do you have a link to a recording of the long ago exchange between Chomsky and Kunstler? I missed that and would like to hear it. And no, I didn't even, I mean, I remember hearing the conversation way back in the day when it happened. And I was definitely on Jim Kunstler's side at the time and very disappointed in Chomsky, you know, for taking Daniel Jurgen seriously. But, you know, to summarize that for that podcast that I did a few weeks ago, I didn't actually re-listen to the conversation. I don't know where to find it. Just a portion of the transcript was available. I think it was on resilience.org. But what I shared with you was pretty much all there was to share, you know, from the portion of the transcript that I had access to. Brent goes on, I'm sorry Art Berman lumped you into a class of people without knowing you. I've enjoyed hearing Berman talk to Kunstler and to Martinson. His analysis of U.S. petroleum extraction in the next year or two makes sense to me. It will be interesting to see if he's right. So, you know, I don't follow Art Berman's his analysis very closely, but I was, you know, in the aftermath of being insulted by him without, you know, as far as I know, him knowing me. I certainly don't know him. I was looking, you know, at I went back in time and I was looking at some of his writings from like 2011. Just to see if he was predicting doom, like the peak oil folks, and he wasn't. He was talking about projected trends for oil production in the 2030s, you know, which is to say he wasn't expecting a total collapse of industrial civilization anytime before then. So, you know, I don't have any particular beef with Art Berman other than, you know, he's clearly been conditioned by Twitter to be, you know, just insulting at the drop of a hat to people he doesn't know. You know, maybe he was like that before Twitter, but he certainly seems to have a bad case of Twitter brain now. Brent continues, I was rather sleepy when I listened to your talk with Jim, the ad attacker, but it seems like both of you don't think climate change is as big of a problem as I think it is. I notice Jorgen's book has climate in the title, and that's one reason I hope you give us a book review. If I understand the snippet from Chomsky, climate change is the point he thought Kunstler was missing. I have enjoyed consuming JHK for a long time, too, though, as I was never as miffed with him as I was during his last, I think, interview with David Collum, where they both gave the right-wing climate change denial talking points. I'm not in the near-term human extinction camp, but I do appreciate people like Noam Chomsky and Chris Hedges, who can talk about a wide variety of issues without being dismissive or defeatist about climate change. I encourage you to keep putting out audio. I'm struggling with a YouTube habit and I aspire to reduce my hidden energy burden of instructing faraway servers with a few taps on my phone to stream me data to stream me data for my entertainment. I have discovered a way to play audio only on an iPhone, but it's a hassle and I rarely do it. I'd encourage you to consider if what you publish really benefits from the video or not. That will give you something to think about during your YouTube timeout and eat your peas, too. All right, so this is not the end of the email, but I'll pause here and respond to that. You know, there were some videos where I did a lot of visual work. You know, I put in a lot of stills, a lot of backgrounds. I shot against a green screen with a teleprompter. And these are the videos that have gotten the most views, but they take a lot of work. And the thing that I like about YouTube is that I can just shoot a quick video on my phone, do very minimal editing with a video editor that's really just an app on my phone, and then upload directly from my phone to YouTube. It's a very quick process, particularly compared to an audio podcast, which is a much more time-consuming process. And it's just, you know, it's a quick way to get content out there. Now, ideally, it would also be a good way to reach a different audience, but that hasn't worked out. Really, the audience that I have on YouTube is just a fraction of the CRealm audience that knows to look for me on YouTube as well. So it's a very small group of people I'm talking to there, but it is an interesting way, you know, it's a quick way for me to produce content. It's a way for me to explore ideas in real time without writing, which I just haven't been able to bring myself to do in recent years. The video aspect to me is really neither here nor there. You know, I do put in my false front teeth when I shoot a video, or I try to remember to do that. I did at least run my fingers through my hair to keep from looking like a, you know, the shut-in madman that I have become. But I'm really not thinking about the visuals very much. It's really just the ease of creating and sharing content that appeals to me with YouTube. And, you know, the fact that I watch a lot of YouTube, you know, it's you do as well, so you understand. You understand the appeal. Even, you know, a lot of times I'll put on like a long lecture and there's a camera on the lecturers, but if it's just, you know, audio content that I'm mostly interested in, I'll do something else while I listen to that. So yeah, for a lot of the stuff on YouTube, the video is irrelevant. I mean, a lot of people put up podcasts on YouTube where they just have a still image for the entire hour or 90 minutes or, you know, however long the conversation is. But that's still video streaming. It's still a lot more data that has to be transferred via wires and radio frequency and, you know, waves bounced off satellites and pulses of light down fiber optic cables and, you know, lots of churning servers in the server farms. It's more data than it needs to be, I realize. Now, one ray of hope is that you know, not only do computers get smaller and faster and cheaper and more powerful over time, but they also use less energy, you know, per unit of information processed or transmitted. I forget the law, the name of that law, but, you know, it's regular enough that, like Moore's law, it has a moniker. So, yeah, we use a lot of electricity now to mine Bitcoin and to watch cat videos. That'll be less. It might be a greater volume. I mean, it may be a greater total amount of electricity used over time, but it will be a lot more information transmitted and shared with that energy. So Brent continues, something Paul Kingsnorth said about the cumulative effect of powering the internet really gave me pause. The gist of it was that when Greta Thunberg sailed across the Atlantic, if she spent the whole time on her phone, she may as well have flown. I'm not sure the magnitudes are correct, but I agree with the sentiment. Well, how about this? Greta Thunberg sailed across the ocean, but she didn't really sail. She was conveyed by a team of sailors across the ocean on a sailboat so that she wouldn't fly. Supposedly, you know, to save or to minimize the carbon footprint or the environmental impact of her journey. But the crew members all had to assemble in the place from which she departed. And how did they get there? They got there by plane. And then, you know, they took her across the Atlantic on the boat and then they flew home. It's much worse than her being on her phone the whole time. The her being on her phone the whole time is just a sign of, you know, the neurological and behavioral addiction of these information technology tools. But, you know, the stunt, the virtue signal, the grand virtue signal of, oh, I'm going to sail across the Atlantic rather than burn all that jet fuel and fly, cost a lot more jet fuel than it would have cost for her to just fly. It was not only, you know, counterproductive, it was grossly counterproductive if her actual aim was to minimize the climate impact of her travel. And Brent ends with, hang in there with the social isolation. I think it's going to get better before long. Best regards, Brent. Oh, boy, I sure hope so. Okay, so let me back up a little bit because I got this email out because I wanted to respond to the question of climate change. Brent writes, I was rather sleepy when I listened to the talk with Jim the Edattacker, but it seems like both of you don't think climate change is as big of a problem as I think it is. Well, I don't know exactly what the magnitude of your belief is, you know, in terms of how bad it's going to be. I'm just agnostic about it. But I'm particularly fixated on the inequalities, the social and economic inequalities of the present moment. If I look at myself compared to the years after I just left Amazon.com, well, you know, I leased a nice car. It was a Lexus SUV. I lived in a freestanding large home out on the Olympic Peninsula with my wife and son. We ate out a lot. Because we lived out in the country, we had to drive a very long way to get groceries. And I would drive regularly, you know, a half hour each way to go to a Tai Chi class up in Port Townsend, Washington. And I had a much, much bigger carbon footprint than I do now. Now I live in an apartment in a larger building. It's not an apartment building. It's actually an office building. But I live in what used to be a doctor's office, you know, kind of a repurposed space. I don't know, you know, how much electricity I use. My utilities are included here in the price of rent. But I don't drive. I rarely travel. You know, when I was fresh from Amazon, I spent a lot of time on planes and in airports. I did a lot of traveling. So my carbon footprint is way lower now than it was, you know, when I was fresh out of Amazon. But that's to be expected. You know, I was flush with cash then. But even like a decade ago, when the Amazon money was gone and I was just scrambling, you know, to try to make a living and support a family, I was doing a lot of driving. You know, I was selling insurance and I was traveling around to talk to clients. And later on, I was doing customer service for Comcast. And, you know, the place where I lived was more than an hour, more like an hour and a half from the place where I worked. So I spent 3 hours a day driving, you know, and I wasn't a rich guy. I was a struggling guy. So, yeah, now my carbon footprint is way lower. But I suspect that the Davos set and, you know, folks like Bill Gates or Leonardo DiCaprio, who claim to be really, really concerned about the environment and yet who live extravagant, extravagant lifestyles where they, you know, they have enormous carbon footprints. Or, you know, Al Gore is the most nauseating example of this. I suspect that, you know, their proposal for addressing climate change is that people like me have to shrink their footprint even further. And that people living in, you know, what we used to call the third world or in the developing world or the global south or whatever you want to call it, people who have even smaller footprints, you know, carbon footprints than I do, that they should just be happy with what they have and live at the level at which they're living, even though the elites are going to continue to, you know, have enormous, enormous carbon footprints, but they're going to make up for it by being, you know, morally haughty and superior and scolding the rest of us. Well, that brings to mind a psychological experiment called the ultimatum game. The ultimatum game, it's usually played, you know, with money, but it can be played with food because it's been, you know, it's a game that has been studied repeatedly with both humans, chimps, and bonobos. And when you do it with money, we'll say there's $100 that one person, the proposer, gets to just divide into two portions. And, you know, one portion for themselves, one portion for the other person in the game. The other person in the game is called the responder. So the proposer proposes a split and the responder decides whether to take it or not. And if you're looking at it from a strictly utilitarian economic perspective, if we are, as you know, the economists like to say, homo economicus, we are just, you know, utility maximizers, we're going to do what's best for us. Well, if I propose a split of, here's $100, or I think I should get $99.99 and you should get one penny. And I put that proposal on the table. Well, if you're a homo economicus, for you, one penny is better than nothing. But if you reject the deal, then I get nothing. And what these experiments have consistently found is that around the 70-30, that's about as much as most humans or primates will accept in terms of, you know, taking the short end of the stick. A lot of people, most people, would rather punish an unfair proposer than accept the benefits of the unfair proposal, even though, you know, the unfair proposal gets them more than the nothing they're going to get otherwise. And something I found really interesting when I reviewed this on Wikipedia before I started talking about it was that, and it's not surprising in the least, it's that intoxication magnifies the effect of rejecting unfair bargains. Normally, it's around the proposer gets 70, the responder gets 30. That's about where, you know, the responder starts to reject the offer and say, nope, nobody gets anything. But if the responder is drunk, they get there quicker. And I think as a society, we're kind of drunk on rage right now. We're really angry at each other. And right now, it is the top tier of people who are being very clever about keeping the bottom tiers angry at each other, you know, different factions of the bottom tiers angry at each other, rather than everybody on the bottom tier being angry at the top tier. You know, I was talking to, doesn't matter who I was talking to. I was talking to somebody recently who just kept talking about how awful race relations are right now. And, you know, I just thought back to, like, every time I head into the interior of the country, if I go to some place like Missouri, you know, which is where I grew up, I see working class Black and white people hanging out together all the time. I was just reading here. I'm going to go grab the book. This is from John Michael Greer's most recent book. John Michael Greer's recent book is The King in Orange, The Magical and Occult Roots of Political Power. So this is from the very beginning of the book. Chapter one, A Season in Carcosa. I'm not going to read the opening quotation from The King in Yellow, but John Michael Greer writes, like millions of other Americans, on November 8th, 2016, I took part in the pleasant civic ritual of electing a president. My polling place at the time was in an elementary school in a rundown neighborhood of Cumberland, Maryland, a gritty, impoverished, and rather pleasant town of 20,000 people in the north-central Appalachians, and I walked there early that afternoon when the lunch rush was over and the torrent of people voting on the way home from work hadn't gotten underway. There was no line at the polling place. I went in just as two old men came out the door comparing notes on which local restaurants gave discounts to patrons who wear the I've voted stickers that polling places hand out, and left 5 minutes after as a bottle-blonde housewife in her 50s came in to cast her vote. Maryland had electronic voting for a while, but did the smart thing and went back to paper ballots that year, so I'm pretty sure my votes got counted the way I cast them. The weather was cloudy but warm, as nice a November day as you could ask for, and the streets I walked down were typical of the poorer parts of flyover country. Every third house abandoned, every third street corner hosting an off-brand church. It's the kind of neighborhood where, On a warm summer evening, all the porches have people sitting on them, and despite the stereotypes you'll hear endlessly repeated in the corporate media, you'll have to look long and hard to find even one of those porches where everyone tipping back a beer has the same skin color. The kids playing basketball in the rundown playground close by are just as complete an ethnic mix, and interracial marriages and mixed-race children are common in that part of town. That afternoon, as I went to vote and then returned, that impoverished, rundown, ebulliently multiracial neighborhood was also an unbroken forest of pro-Trump signage. Trump's name and his slogan, "Make America Great Again," were everywhere. And Clinton? If you wanted to see any of her signs, you had to walk uphill to a different part of town. That way lies one of Cumberland's few well-to-do neighborhoods, where you won't see friends tipping back beers on porches or mixed-race couples walking down the street holding hands. That's where you found the Clinton campaign signs, "I'm with her," on that pleasant November afternoon. They were with her. The working-class people down the hill, struggling to get by after decades of increasing bleak times in America's flyover states, were with Trump. That wasn't the way the corporate media or the comfortable classes presented the contest, of course. After that November day, and especially once the shock of Hillary Clinton's defeat settled in, the conventional wisdom insisted loudly that every single person who voted for Donald Trump must have been motivated by racism, sexism, or some other form of socially unacceptable prejudice, and could not possibly have had any other reason for voting that way. The same media outlets and affluent circles insisted just as stridently that Trump colluded with the government of Russia to rig the election or simply blamed Trump's victory on hate, as though that unfashionable emotion had done the thing all by itself. So, you know, I very much agree with John Michael Greer there. When I go to the parts of the country where you have a lot of poor and working class people of various races, you know, working cheek by jowl and living cheek by jowl, they seem to get along pretty well. You have to go to the blue cities in the blue states, you know, to find the anger over race. And, you know, look at the places where people are rioting and, you know, fighting cops and burning buildings and things. It's not in the South. You know, it's not in the formerly industrial Midwest. It's not in the Appalachians. You know, it's in the North and it's on the coasts. And, you know, this is not an area of obsession for me. So I don't have a bunch of statistics or citations at the ready. But when people tell me, you know, people who for whom this is an important issue, when they tell me that they have, you know, good reason to believe that people and organizations like George Soros's Open Society are funneling money to organizations like Antifa and Black Lives Matter in order to, you know, whip up this appearance of, you know, worsening racial relations. Well, to some extent, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. But, you know, for people getting off work and going to pick up a 12-pack of beer, you know, in their pickup truck in Missouri and go to the lake to drink it, they're not obsessed about race. They're the folks who are, you know, they're having mixed-race marriages and mixed-race babies and mixed-race friendships, and it's all good. You have to go to the centers of white privilege to get this, you know, this furor about just how unworkable racial relationships are in the United States and just how dedicated, systemically dedicated, the entire U.S., you know, apparatus, government, corporate, private, is to disadvantaging people of color. When, you know, just look around. That's not how people behave. So back to climate change and the ultimatum game. So I think that elites and their, you know, their minions and useful idiots are going to do everything they can to keep working class people from forming solidarity with one another and pushing back in a concerted and intelligent way against the elites. And right now, they're, you know, they're using primarily race and gender, but also, you know, other categories of oppression to keep working people angry at each other and to keeping them from forming effective common cause against the elites. What does this have to do with the ultimatum game? Well, I think it's pretty clear that the Davos set doesn't plan to give up private jets or yachts or the high carbon intensity lifestyle that, you know, that pleases them. But they want us to tighten our belts even more. And I'm like the drunk monkey. You hand me an unfair deal and say, take this or we all burn. Well, I say fucking burn. Let it all burn down. You know, climate change is not going to destroy all life on Earth, but it very well could destroy human civilization. And if it does, and, you know, the only thing the elites were willing to offer was moral haughtiness and self-congratulation for them and belt tightening for everybody else, you know, I reject that offer. So That's not necessarily an answer to your question of how seriously do I take climate change, but that's how I respond to proposals to address climate change. If the main strategy for addressing climate change is the same strategy that the, you know, the elite institutions and government use to address COVID-19, which is transfer wealth immediately from everybody to the top, no chance. No chance will I endorse that. No. And I don't care how bad climate change is. I don't care how quickly and how high the seas rise. If that's your only proposed solution, I'm not going for it. You know, there's an Australian leftist blogger. Her name's Caitlin Johnstone. And she's a good articulator of the sins of the United States. But she absolutely categorically refuses to say anything bad about China. And she says, you know, this will be probably in her mind an unfair paraphrase of her position, but she's, you know, she says she can't say anything bad about China because that might make the United States look good, and the United States is the devil. And my position on climate change is kind of similar to that. It's like, I don't even care. I don't care about climate change. I'm not even willing to talk about it until we get the whole social equity thing worked out. As long as the elites are in charge and they get to be in the proposer's role, you know, for proposing what solutions to climate change are even mentionable, I'm not interested in the topic. You know, my life has contracted enough. I will not voluntarily let it contract any further in the service of combating climate change. Not while there are still people scooting around in private jets, to, you know, to one of their 10 houses. Now, I've spoken of fear being the mind killer and fear, you know, being so corrosive to rational thought that largely it's a sin to propagate it and to tolerate it in yourself, particularly when it's fear of abstractions like climate change. But I also recognize that anger is corrosive. I mean, I've told you right up front, the rational thing for me to do, you know, as the responder in the ultimatum game is no matter how short of a stick I'm offered, I should take it. If Jeff Bezos says I get $99.99 and you get 1 cent, and, you know, that's his proposed solution to climate change, I should accept that. I should say, okay, you got it, man. Great. I'm doing my part. But no, I recognize that saying, fuck it, let the whole goddamn thing burn is not the rational point of view. But at the same time, I won't be bullied with rationality. I won't be cowed. I won't be subjected to coercion in the name of rationality. You know, many years ago, I read a piece by Bruce Sterling where he offered up a few lifestyle choices for dealing with climate change. One, he said, spend a lot of money and get a really good chair because you're going to spend a lot of time sitting in it. Spend a lot of money and get a really good bed because you're going to spend a lot of time in that bed. And then in terms of lifestyle, don't try to be greener than your dead grandfather. Don't try to have a smaller carbon footprint than a corpse. Because if your overriding concern is carbon emissions, well, you know, the most rational thing to do is suck a tailpipe, is to take yourself out of the equation. And, you know, within a certain context, within a certain frame, that's the rational thing to do. But when rationality prescribes sucking a tailpipe, or when rationality prescribes taking the short end of the stick, then, you know, rationality has exceeded its utility. Fuck it. So, that's my current thinking on climate change. And that's the extent of this episode of the podcast. It's gone on much longer than I had intended. All right, I'll talk to you again soon. Send me email. Or, you know, post comments, crealm.com, or Patreon, or YouTube. I know they're kind of scattered all over the place, and I don't always find them and pull them together, you know, very successfully when I want to try to do a show on a particular theme using listener feedback, but I do appreciate it. I do appreciate it in the moment that I read it, and I usually respond to it in writing. So keep it coming. And stay well.